DevBot is a tried and tested way of convincing otherwise intelligent, sensible people to strand themselves in the middle of nowhere, where they're at risk of starvation, hypothermia, whiskey, and too many pop culture references. And as a side effect, we build websites. So we take about a dozen people, obviously an isolated location, no internet, no phones, cut off from civilization as much as possible, no meetings, no phone calls from people desperately asking that you come and clear their toilet. A week to choose an idea, come up with it, design it, build it. We've built a bunch of things already. We built Wildlife Near You, although that's sadly down because we forgot to pay the hosting bill for it. And then we forgot to pay for the DNS registration. It's very embarrassing, that. We built Mostly Final, History Mesh, most recently something called Be Habitual, and we're probably best known for Spacelog. Why would anyone do that? Why would anyone go away to the middle of nowhere and then try and do their day job, particularly without the internet? For a number of reasons. Firstly, it can be really, really pretty. And going somewhere that is really pretty is just... Hopefully I don't have to sell you on the idea that that's nice. Some people don't like it. They wouldn't like forts quite so much, I suspect. And also, if you're like me, then you live in London and you work in London, and you probably spend most of your time in London or in other cities a bit like London. Going somewhere very, very different can cause interesting things to happen in your brain. And that can kick off new ideas, new ways of thinking about stuff, and make you open to possibilities that maybe you wouldn't have considered before. Also, sometimes it's fun to hang out with other people from your tribe, which is kind of why we're all here today. And it's good to learn things from people that you wouldn't normally get to work with, which is another reason that we're here today. And of course, without distractions, you can get a huge amount done. This is George committing a key piece of code to Be Habitual from the battlements of a fort, which is one of my favorite photos from the last couple of years. And actually, when you put all of this together, it can revitalize your interest in doing your day job in the first place. When I first started doing forts, I was kind of burned out on building things for the web. And then I went to a fort and I had a lot of fun, and I remembered why it's fun to do these things. Something that happens at DevFort is a group of people who don't know each other very well come together and start acting as a really effective team remarkably quickly. And so I want to talk about some of the things that we've seen or that we do that maybe apply when you're not in a fort. Because most companies can't just lock their team away for a week in the middle of nowhere. That's illegal. And it's not necessarily a good idea even if it weren't illegal. But there are things that you can take from the fort and maybe use it in other environments. None of this is particularly radical. A lot of these ideas are things that managers and people thinking about sort of social implications of teams and communities have been thinking about for a long time. But it's quite easy to forget that when you're in the thick of just trying to get your job done. And there's a surprising number of companies that seem to have managers who believe that the way you make a team is you say, you people over there, you're a team now, go and be really effective. And you just can't do that. You don't create a team from the outside. You don't create a team by lecturing people. You don't create a team by telling people, you're going to be great together now. You can't impose culture. You have to let it sort of coalesce from within the team itself. What you want to do is help people work together and become a team. At Forts, it's slightly artificial. We're all part of one team. And so it's very different to in a large company where you're going to have people who care about whether the team is effective or not who aren't part of that team. In startups, you're quite often in a situation early on where the company is just one team. And everyone, up to the CEO, maybe even the investors, are working closely together on a day-to-day basis. Obviously, as companies get bigger, then things change. Teams do seem to form faster under pressure, and they bond faster and start working better. But the type of pressure that you put them under is important. You can't just give people a whole load of deadlines and expect them to become a team. Well, actually, you can. They will become a team, but they'll become a team filled of hate. They'll really, really hate you for that. But if the team decides to accept pressure itself, then that does seem to move them together faster. It's surprising how few teams have a clear idea of what they're trying to do. It's actually surprising how few companies have a clear idea of what they're trying to do, and it's a little bit depressing. But even the companies that have a clear idea of what they're trying to do, quite often they don't communicate it to everyone in the company who could maybe help them get it done. If a team knows what it's trying to do, the kind of communication that happens within it moves them towards the goal better than if they're sort of all pointed in slightly different directions and you have a manager constantly having to beat them into the right direction. Teams are like little communities. So it isn't surprising that after a while they start developing their own language, and that comes from in a number of forms. Obviously you get some jargon from whatever it is you're working on. A shared vocabulary for the things that you're talking about is really important. At DevVault we consider it sufficiently important that we try to put up a poster or a whiteboard or something on a wall somewhere which spells out the vocabulary of the key parts of the system, and we keep it updated. There's a couple of reasons for that. Firstly, doing it at the beginning really helps identify the places where we don't have consensus, where some people think that we're doing something slightly different to what everyone else thinks they're doing. And secondly, because we have had situations where people accidentally tried to call two different types of things by the same word and spent hours and hours arguing with each other when actually they should have been agreeing all the time, they were just using the wrong words. There are other types of language that develop. Nicknames can just be a playful thing. Within a team, you get a little bit of culture and you get jokes emerge. Nicknames can be part of that. Sometimes they're absolutely necessary. One of the first companies I worked in had six people, four of whom were called James. Amazingly, I was the one who was still called James once we'd assigned nicknames. I'm not quite sure how I got away with that. When we were building Spacelog, which this photo is from, we were all named after astronomical objects. Although I can't remember why, and I can't remember, we had the sun and the moon, and presumably eight planets, and I don't know what the other ones were. Nobody can remember. Something that we noticed at the last Ford, and I've noticed in other situations, is teams evolve their own jokes. Shorthand, fun ways of remembering and reminding themselves that they're part of a little community. And quite often they start from the outside. So if you've got a bunch of web professionals, or to be honest, these days, pretty much anyone, some of their jokes will come from the internet, whatever's current on Twitter or Tumblr or anything like that. But gradually these things will evolve. At the last Fort, we referenced one animated GIF so many times that eventually it just became the gesture that. And there are 13 people in the world who know what that means. And that's kind of okay, because having a team that can communicate really efficiently within themselves is often more useful than having blank confusion when they talk to other people. That's not really a huge problem. However, there is a dark side to this, which is a team may start making jokes that they're all comfortable with, but no one else is. And it seems to me that really tight-knit teams tend to do this. I've seen it in a number of different situations. They find their limits of taste and decency. And then a lot of the jokes sort of skirt the edge of that. Which means everything's fine, providing no one else comes in. So you have a problem when you hire new people. You have to back off a bit and then figure out what they're comfortable with and then push it back out again. There's another potential problem which I've seen more than once. If you have a team that's talking all day on an IRC channel, and then someone from outside the team goes and looks at the chat logs, you can, at best, they might be mildly surprised. At worst, they might be mortally offended. This is quite a lot of small companies talk about eating together. I say quite a lot. There's sort of a few that make a thing of like, oh, eating together really helps get a community. And that's great, but we found that cooking together is even better. And I have a sort of theory about this, that active social things are better at bonding people together than passive social things like just eating or talking, which is kind of the theory, I guess, behind team bonding exercises like let's all go to Dartmoor and camp out over the weekend. And if we don't die of exposure, then we're a team. When I was writing this talk yesterday, I Googled for team bonding just to sort of see what opportunities there are around London to do team bonding. And one of the top adverts was for corporate cooking classes. So I'm sticking with cook together. It's good for you. You can go a lot further than just cooking together, of course. At Forts, we don't just cook together. We eat, we cook, we laugh, we drink, we give impromptu performances of Gangnam Style. I don't necessarily suggest that you go that far. That's a bit far for most, but it's a bit far for us, to be honest. Going back to an earlier point, teams form from within. So figure out what makes sense for the team, rather than just deciding, hey, you're all going to go cooking now. And remember that as teams grow, there is a difference between a team and a company. And it's okay that a company that started off being small enough that it had just one community, one fast-functioning team, gradually evolves into multiple different teams. And each team itself can be really, really effective within it. But the communication between the other bits requires more work. It's not going to, you're not going to be able to necessarily have it just happen automatically. And again, there's a dark side if you don't pay attention to that. I've seen this happen. If you're the CEO and you notice that one of your teams, say all of your designers and developers, are going out for breakfast once a week, and they're getting together and they're just sort of talking and hanging out, and you think, well, that's a great idea, so you decide to go along with them. At that point, you have probably broken that team forever. Because they had a nice social opportunity to work as a team. You don't work with them in the same way, and they were probably making jokes about you, and they can't do that anymore. I wasn't the only person who took some of these photos. There are some by other people. And you may be wondering, how do I come to a fort? We run about 2 a year at the moment, which isn't very many. We don't get to take very many people. And so I am trying to talk to potential sponsors, see if we can find ways of running more by using more of my time. But in the meantime, if you're interested, if this doesn't sound terrifying and horrible to you, then do come to talk to me, or we've got some other people here and at OpenTech today who've come to Forts over the years. Thank you very much.
Thanks for that, James, and you finished on time as well. We've got a couple of minutes left. We're told all chairs are shouted at by Sam to make sure we all finish exactly on time at pain of death type thing. So it's always good to have speakers who listen. So are there any immediate questions for James there? No? Okay, while we're setting up there quickly for the next speaker, what's the biggest challenge you think you've faced?
Well, we did get caught in a blizzard last time. As in, the blizzard came down, the airport shut, we were stuck in Alderney for 3 days without any real planning in advance for that happening.
Did you have enough food?
Had we stayed where we were, we would not have had enough food. We made the perhaps slightly foolish but ultimately benign decision to walk through the blizzard to the airport just to make absolutely sure that it was closed, but also because we had to go and talk to them about, you know, maybe rebooking on other days. If we'd stayed at 4 o'clock where we were, there was no food, and the island shut for 2 days. No one was able to get out. We wouldn't have been able to get any more food, and we would have run out of whiskey, even more importantly.
Fair enough. Thank you ever so much. So next up, we've got David from NHS Hackaday. Go for it.
Hi. So I'm going to talk to you about NHS Hackaday, which is about geeks who love the NHS. First proposition is that the NHS is a good thing. And this is quite understated, but this is the jumping off point for my involvement with the whole thing and generally kind of why there's so much enthusiasm for it. The NHS is universal access to healthcare free at the point of use. And it's worth remembering, particularly in times when there's so much public crisis around the NHS, that actually it's a pretty amazing thing. It's one of the great things about living in Britain, and one of the things that we've achieved. Second proposition is that technology and IT in the NHS is kind of broken. which is, again, understated. But it comes up in many kind of ways. So I get emails from doctors late at night who are working in hospital wards, and they've got some information system which has broken horribly and is stopping them from doing their job. And then they go to their internal IT issue tracking system to report this issue to someone. But the issue tracking system is also broken. And so they send me an email going, "Oh, I thought you'd appreciate the irony in this. Here's Stacktrace." And the first time that happens, the first time you find a bug in a bug tracker, there's a lovely irony to it. Second, third, fourth time you get emails like this, it's quite profoundly disturbing. I mean, it leads you to question your life choices, why people think it's appropriate to email you random file not found SAC traces. But beyond that, it brings up the fact that there is some kind of, we're not doing this well enough. And the NHS is so important that we need to do it properly there. On another level, it's kind of broken in as much as if you talk to doctors about the way they use software, it's not the way I use software. Because I use software in a way that's kind of an extension of my brain, and it's seamless and it improves my life. Whereas what you hear from them is that it gets in the way and stops them doing stuff. And they spend as much time fighting the software as getting real value from it. And that's, for that to be happening in something as important as healthcare, is not a great situation. Going up another level kind of to that, you end up in a world of, it's strategically broken, in a kind of procurement sense, in a kind of, it's a world of lots of proprietary closed source standards fighting each other, and you can't get your data in and out, and you can't migrate stuff, you have vendor lock-in, and all this kind of stuff. We're not doing procurement of IT services in the NHS particularly well. So, the third proposition is that broken isn't necessarily a problem, you just have to fix it. Now, just fix the NHS isn't quite as simple as, well, there's another level of detail that I haven't put up on this slide. But the class of problems that you're dealing with a lot of the time are essentially solved problems. There are some real, genuine kind of software engineering challenges which are very, very difficult, but the things that really cause problems on a ward day to day are things which would be solved by the slow and painstaking process of taking the existing building blocks that we have and putting them together in the right configuration with an idea of focusing on what the end user actually wants to do and actually needs to accomplish. So, how do you fix this? I mean, where do you start with this? If the problem is not essentially fundamentally a technical one, it's a cultural and political one, there is a very real need to go and deal with this at a kind of political strategic level. The problem with that is it's very hard and it takes a long time. We had the GDS people talking about how it took them 10 years to get something even vaguely like that going. We are a long way behind that in the NHS. And the NHS is also a deeply fragmented organisation. It's very difficult to get the NHS to do anything. So it becomes very, very difficult to actually force anything top down. It's worth trying, it's worth having the conversations with people. And in general, when you talk to people who are on the NHS commissioning board, let's say, they kind of understand open source and open technology and let's do agile iterative development and all these nice things that we'd like to do rather than spending huge amounts of money writing a spec that would take 15 years to implement and cost £9 billion. They kind of realise that that might not be a great idea, partly because they've done it and it's failed. So, question two is, if we're going to go from a bottom-up approach, what does that look like? Broadly, it looks like getting communities of clinical staff, doctors, nurses, registrars, all these kinds of people together who, with technical people, who have an enthusiasm to improve the NHS. Kind of getting a whole sense of a grassroots movement around these kind of people who understand what the future would look like. So that's the first thing. The second thing is lots of small pieces loosely joined, which individually solve one small problem and make the life of one doctor slightly better. I mean, that's a really profound thing. And then you just repeat. So, as a response, as a way to deal with that problem, there is this event called NHS Hack Day, which is largely what it says on the tin. It's a hack day for the NHS. This is a photograph that was taken in that room over there a year ago for the first NHS Hack Day. Since then, we've held two more events. The next one runs next week, next weekend, in this building. And it's a really kind of fun experience, and you get a whole bunch of people with different domain expertise talking to each other, and suddenly you get a bunch of people from the techie open source community who understand the domain problems just that much better, are enthusiastic about the existence of the low-hanging fruit, because there's so much of it. And you get a whole bunch of doctors who are really enthusiastic about the possibility for change and the possibility for it being better. Just a kind of win-win situation. But there's a problem with kind of hack days and hackathons in general, which is that what you end up with, it's great. You have all these people who come here and they get really enthusiastic and really excited and build some cool stuff, but it's basically a cobbled together prototype which puts some dots on a Google map. And that's not that useful. So, how do you deal with that, and how do you kind of try and move on from there, move on from a world where you have all these neat prototypes which could help into, let's get it into a clinical setting. So you need some kind of map. This is what happened in Oxford. This was the map of the things that were going on there. But this isn't enough. What you need is a map that goes from here and takes those projects into a hospital. And unfortunately, there's no really good, easy answer for how to do that. But broadly, the answer is patience, perseverance, hard work, slowly, one step at a time. It's the same as the answer for, most hard problems. But stuff has come out of the hack days, which is fantastic. So I'm going to talk to you about two things which have come out and genuinely kind of made a difference in a clinical setting and helped some doctors out. So the first one is Cell Counter, which is a project that was built in a day and a half. And the broad problem is you have a hematologist who's spent years and years and years in medical training, very highly trained, looking through a 2.5 grand microscope at very small stuff and counting some stuff in it and doing some diagnostic calculations. And then in order to do the calculations, they have essentially an abacus, literally a mechanical counting device, which was bought in 1953 and takes a huge amount of time to operate. And there was a great kind of hematology doctor called Wei Qiong who identified this abacusy thing as the bottleneck in the process. And so over a couple of days, they built this thing which basically turns your web browser into a custom input device for a very specific kind of data entry. And it does some basic diagnostic calculations. And this speeds up the process so much that not only did he take this into his ward and his hospital, but then all his colleagues started using it because it's just so much quicker. And then a couple of months ago, this has been taken to a second hospital ward, and they're beginning to go to medical conferences and say, look at this cool thing we did. It will speed your task up. This kind of thing that was taking 8 hours of your week, you can now do it in 4, and that's pretty cool. So that's in hospitals now. So the second project is a thing called Opal, which is currently an empty GitHub repository. But there is more in the future. The problem is, it's a patient-less problem. So you go into a ward in a hospital, and you hope, probably, that somebody there is keeping some kind of record of who you are, where you are, what's wrong with you,
who stuck what needle in you. And you're right, broadly, but the system they're using to do this tends to be, well, there's a Word document on that computer in that corner over there, and then there's this bloke who doesn't actually work on this ward, but he does a lot of medical stuff here, and he's got his own Excel spreadsheet down there. And then there's the people who live in the basement who come up and change what antibiotics you're on, and they've got these A5 little pieces of paper that they staple together and throw at the back of a filing cabinet. And this is amazingly the system that we all know and love as inpatient care in the NHS. But it's a system which has several points of failure. So, first hack day, some people built a prototype patient list system which gave you a nice interface for we can do this and we can do it kind of vaguely sensibly. We can have some sense of revision control. Let's say, who did what? Let's have some traceability. And that was your typical abandonware hack day project. There was loads of enthusiasm, but it turned out that they tried to move it on, they tried to push it on, but they slowly, slowly ran out of steam because everyone had day jobs and everyone had other commitments and they couldn't quite get it into a hospital and they had to do all these integrations and it just died a death. But in large part because of the enthusiasm for the project which was generated from the first hack day, we've gone it, so as well as running NHS Hack Day, I'm also with a company called Open Healthcare, who are working to try and move open source, transparent applications for doctors into the NHS. So building on the excitement for this system, which would make stuff better, we've recently, 2 weeks ago, we signed a contract with the NHS to go in and build a clinically led version of this idea to solve this patient, this problem. And it's going to be built essentially by going in once a week and having doctors from three specialities in the sprint planning meeting, which is quite different and new as a procurement contract from the NHS. It's also GPL3 mandated in the contract from the NHS, which is quite interesting. I don't really want to start a license trolling debate, but that's quite an interesting step forward, that you can have GPL3 contracts mandated by the NHS. Quite cool. I'm quite excited about that. So, we're going to be going and building this, and by the time, I don't know, maybe next year, we'll have a success story for this thing actually having helped loads of patients. But the idea is that stuff is coming out of these hack days, and it is going into the NHS, and it is making a difference to actual doctors and helping their lives, which is very, very cool, because the NHS is pretty neat. Which returns me to my slightly altered original slide. So, NHS Hack Day. Geeks who love the NHS at the ubiquitously named nhshackday.com, where you can go and not quite sign up because we're kind of sold out. But it's happening next weekend, and if anyone would like to come, then come and chat to me and we can probably make space. That's that. You should definitely sign up to the mailing list. It's a very fun thing to be involved with. Always good fun.
So, it's really great talk. Everyone's very much engaged in that. So, you've got this captive audience here. Other than signing up, is there anything else that they can do to help you?
We're very interested in sponsorship from sane, responsible companies. If you would like to buy prizes or lunch for future events, then that would be fantastic. But there are a community of projects which have come out of the Hack Day which are always looking for volunteers, which are always looking for people to go and work with them. And if you have any ideas at all for how to help improve the NHS, then come and get in contact with us.
Are there any other questions? Oh, got a couple of hands to take.
Yeah, more of a statement, I'll keep it short. I sort of got connected to the NHS for the bad reason of having to be in hospital for 3 weeks while they tried to save my life. And
Hello.
And also working for a company that did its best to probably ruin the NHS as one of the contractors. But the one thing that I definitely noticed is there is, as you said, a cultural problem with the way they deal with IT, but even the cultural problem with the way they deal with information. If you've ever sat and watched a trolley load of folders with patient notes being pushed around, and that's their intranet system, you realise quickly that the problem is quite deep. I mean, you touched on it, but I think it's even deeper than that. Partly because I think we sort of assume, well, they're doctors, they're smart guys, they'd have noticed these things, but oddly enough, they haven't. Or rather, it's not something that's of interest to them. Or they don't believe it's of interest, or they believe it's someone else's problem. Very hard for me to tell at this remove, but you've obviously saw that. How do you think you want to deal with that over the coming time?
One hospital ward at a time. In my experience, the minute you get people from the NHS to sit down and go, just stop and think for a second, they are full of brilliant ideas for ways to optimise the process. The cultural change is just a thing of finding someone who's willing to sit there and take some time and help you, and there's an increasing amount of them there. And the more you have, the more you run events like this, the more word gets around.
Okay, was there one other question? I'm going to take one other, and then we'll kind of 30 seconds, minutes, kind of.
So maybe you said, and I perhaps you could just clarify, who is the Hack Day run by? Is it independent?
It's a good question. The Hack Day
is run
by...
How did you get doctors and blah, blah, blah involved? Both bits, but I'll give them up.
We know a few doctors, and there's a mailing list, and they tell other people. It's word of mouth. It's run by a volunteer team who, in practice, are employees of Open Healthcare. It's been funded by the NHS Commissioning Board. It's the largest bulk of the funding at the minute. And then, so it's kind of, it's open accounts, volunteer run out of this Open Healthcare who are, it's happened to be that there's us three who've run them so far. We're always looking for more help. If you'd like to, you know, come in and get them. But if you're volunteering to organise Wi-Fi and catering, then we can book you for later this year.
Thanks for that. So, last up, we've got Beth and Green Ventures. And I'll be honest, I don't know much about you guys. So
you'll find out.
Hi, everybody. My name is Glenn Main, and I'm from Bethel Green Ventures. And I want to talk about the future of kind of startups and where things are going and where things are interesting. And to start with that, I want to talk about my first computer. So on the top left, that's a Timex Sinclair. It's kind of basically the same as a ZX80. That was my first computer. We had some software on tape decks and a very expensive cable to connect it to a tape deck. And in order to get most of the software that you wanted, you had to buy magazines like Compute, and then go through and type in all the, the programs that were in the book and try and debug them. And they always had covers like, you know, Tank Commander, and then you would have a little blob that would just sort of vaguely do something, you know, responding to the screen. That was my second computer that my mom bought there. It was the Apple IIe. And then my dad bought one of these because my dad was a mainframe developer moving into microcomputers. And shortly thereafter, this is not a perfectly linear history of technology, but we had this thing called Lotus 1-2-3. And, you know, it was not the first, but it was a big kind of spreadsheet. And it was kind of revolutionary for a lot of people. It really changed the way that people worked. Shortly after that, the Amiga and some other groups came out, and we had this desktop publishing revolution. And again, this really came in and disrupted industries and really fundamentally shifted. And you had, you know, suddenly you had a whole wave of people who were kind of desktop publishers. So the first time I was on the internet, it kind of looked like that. I remember typing on, you know, saying to somebody, I can do this. I had, you know, War Games had recently been in the cinema, and I thought, you know, I could go and play these big games. And I remember typing and going, all right, there's a computer across town that's receiving my keystrokes. I really know what it does. Not very much later, the next time I saw the internet, you know, soon after that, I spent a lot of time on bulletin board systems, which sort of were the internet, because overnight they would call each other, and you could pass information between these, and it was you would have how many hops things would go. There were internet gateways to these, and not much later, I got my first internet account, my first Linux box. and the internet kind of looked like that. And suddenly it started to look like something much more recognizable. And I think what we've seen, again, is that, you know, that this technological advance has kind of come across and swept away industries and really changed, you know, kind of e-commerce, the way we kind of find information about things, the way we consume music, how we deal with our kind of photo records. But you're all wondering where this is going. So desktop publishing replaced the top left. You know, people used to spend time, you know, pasting out letters. So these the spreadsheets replaced, or you know, greatly affected kind of ledger accounting. Spotify, iTunes, etc. have affected kind of record stores. And all of these things have a few sort of things in common. You know, they're big manual processes that big manual processes often you know, often with some kind of large industry. You know, large kind of dominating industry that's really, really ripe for kind of disruption. So what do we think is next? And what's interesting now? E-commerce was pretty easy. It was a pretty easy one to see, etc. So what do we think is next? Well, we at Mathical Green Ventures, we think that healthcare is ripe for innovation and really disruptive innovation. We think that education is a real place where technology can have a really large and kind of outsized impact. And this may be qualifications, new ways of getting qualifications. This may be replacing qualifications. This may be achieving lifetime learning. But I think we mean education in the largest sense. So everything from, you know, from the Open University to Coursera to MOOCs to Codecademy, etc. And we think we're just at the very beginning of that. And the other one is kind of sustainability. And I think there's the clean tech revolution coming and the clean web revolution. As well, which London's kind of at the center of. So we started out at Social Innovation Camp doing hack days, and at a lot of our hack days, we've seen a lot of the things that my co-panelists have talked about here, a lot of the same kind of team dynamics, and I would reiterate the same thing about what that's really important is not just getting geeks together in a room with doctors, with teachers, with young offenders, with police, with whoever it is that you're working on. Working with, and we think that hack days remain important. in our last call for ideas, which I'll talk about in a moment, about 60 to 70% of our applicants, the teams had either met at a hack day or they had built their prototype at a hack day. We hear a lot about hack day fatigue, or I have heard for the last kind of couple of years that, you know, hack days have kind of had their day. But I don't necessarily agree with that. And we're really excited to be part of this kind of constellation of groups and organizations that are really affecting and all approaching, something approaching kind of a hack day or approaching, you know, kind of cultural change with a number of different models and a number of different approaches. So we're very excited and proud to be part of that. So we're an accelerator program. And we work with some big names, some interesting people. And this is what we do. So we take really, really early stage ventures. It can be a really good idea, or it can be, you could have a prototype. It's more or less the time where you exit a hack day. So it's really early stage ventures. We give you 15 grand. We give you office space in central London for 6 months. We have a big network of investors, and we have a 90-day program. And what we do is we eat together a lot, we talk a lot, and we really try to work with you to take your idea from, you know, kind of proof of concept or from an idea, and within kind of 90 days to have real paying customers, actual users, and be kind of ready to take investment. That all leads up towards a demo day. Last year we had 150, 160 people. Who ate all the pizza that we bought them in about 15 minutes, even though we thought we had over-ordered pizza. And we have all the teams pitch at the end of that. There are some investors in the room, as well as kind of press and other groups. Some of the groups that have come out, there's Fairphone, who were just in the FT this week. They're launching an ethical mobile phone, Android phone. Dr. Doctor is trying to really rethink the way that the way that hospitals relate with NHS patients on an individual basis. Mastodon C are doing big data better and then zero carbon infrastructure. And the Good Gym is trying to take all the energy that people put into exercise and redirect some of that energy into doing some social good at the same time. So we're doing two cohorts a year. We're doing actually interviews next week. But we're going to do 10 teams twice a year, and we're fully funded for kind of another 4 years. It'll be 10 teams per cohort, which is going to be a bit bigger. We've got really nice central London offices. Well, they're very messy right now, but we're fixing them up, so they'll be clean very soon. So applications are going to run twice a year. So the program will run July through September, as well as January through March, and then the applications open in March or open in September. So that's us. So you can follow us at BG_Ventures, or get in touch if you. We're really, really happy to talk to people about their ideas and give kind of really honest feedback. We also are very open to applications by women as well. Thank you very much.